Oliver, have you ever looked into getting a bird?
You know what? I actually, we were just talking about this because there's a place in Santa Monica called Omar's, which was a bird spot, a parrots or some shit. I'm sure, I don't know if Josh, you know about it or not, but my kids were heavily into getting a parrot and 3 years ago or 4 years ago. And so we were very close to actually purchasing a bird. Thank God we didn't.
I think parrots are frightening. I don't, whatever it is in their brains that allow them to talk like humans or mimic humans, there's some sort of Darwinian thing. Were there parrots back in the day? I know they were with pirates, and there are no more pirates that I'm aware of. I mean, like the old school pirates, like with the ones you see of the ones of Penzance, you know?
Yeah. There's no Penzance pirates.
Right. They're pirates. Yeah. They're people out on the ocean robbing people. But I mean, so what I don't understand at all is how these birds, it's like a cat. Like, I've never been a cat person because I feel like, in many ways, they're smarter than me, and I don't want to have anything that could somehow attack me at night that isn't in a cage.
Mm-hmm.
And that's for a parrot. I don't want a parrot walking around, you know, flying around this saying my shit.
You know, first of all, hello, Joe.
Hi,
it's good
Oliver.
To see you. But I like this conversation. I agree. Parrots, it's strange. I don't get it.
Why is it just parrots? Why can't other animals? Why is it just the parrot? Why can other animals?
Oh my
God. I saw a video of a whale talking English or mimicking the sounds that it heard. But why is it just parrots of all animals that can somehow form words? And do they speak other languages? English.
Well,
like, I've only heard an English speaking parrot. Do parrots in Mexico go,
of course. Of course. And in France, they're like, bonjour. Yeah, without a doubt. I mean,
just real quick, I just want to say parrots speaking Japanese is one of my favorite things.
Is that
okay?
On the
first of all, this is Josh. This is Josh, who beautifully edits all of our shows. And I knew that his boner was growing the minute we were talking about parrots.
I'm watching
he had
him
to
up,
chime in.
I'm watching him shake his head. He hates me now because I'm denigrating parrots.
I can't help myself.
I know, Josh. Sorry,
so let me issue an apology now, okay, for all the parrot lovers out there and for all of to the entire Audubon Society. I'm sorry. I'm not picking on parrots. I am not. I'm dumbfounded why it's this one species, this one breed of bird that seems to have cracked the code of speaking whatever language it hears. I don't, and I'm sure there are others, but they're known
they're
for
just,
that.
They're smart. I mean, there's certain parrots, though, that are better talkers than other, and some parrots can't even speak. Am I right, Josh?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. Well, we had a parrot. We had many, actually. My mom was a parrot lover. We had a macaw back in 1986, and he was the love of my mother's life, and it was reciprocated. I mean, Kurt was secondary, basically.
What about you? I mean, maybe this is part of the issue.
I've always been third or fourth.
Tertiary.
Yeah, tertiary.
Okay, so what was the parrot's name?
Yiddish people say.
The real Oliver?
Yeah, my mom named it Oliver. I don't remember. One bird's name was Rut, but this was not this. I don't remember the name.
How did you kill it?
Well, we had to give it away, honestly, because 1986, my brother Wyatt was born, and the parrot, the macaw, was so insanely jealous that it would go after the infant Wyatt and try to basically kill him. To the point where my mom had to give this parrot away, this macaw, had to leave our family.
Where'd Goldie go? Where's Goldie? Where's Goldie?
Fuck Wyatt. Fuck Wyatt. I hate babies. This kid's mowing my lawn.
That is... we had to do that with a rescue, half Vizsla, half pit bull, because when Blake was 3 months, 4 months, 5 months, whatever it was, he just walked up and yanked the thing's tail, and this dog whipped around. I was like, oh, I dove in between the two, And we sent the dog to a trainer, and the trainer's like, no problem. I got this. There ain't a dog that can't be trained, that can't listen to my instruction and get how to be around infants. And then after about 6 months, we went back out there, and the guy's like, yeah, this one's not listening to me at all.
It sounds like you went to like Kentucky to get this dog trainer.
Warrenton, Missouri. Great guy. Became a nice family friend. In fact, adopted our dog, Finley, and uses that dog to break in, quote unquote, new dogs at his training facility.
Wow. Well, I want to get back to cats just really quickly because I was like you. I never, ever liked cats, you know? Just recently, I've been around a few cats and, I'm kind of weirdly feeling them in my middle age. I don't know why. Is this a bad sign? I think it's a bad sign. Isn't it?
I don't know. I'm so scared to say anything anymore. I'm
reaching out for help. I mean, I'm honestly reaching for help. Right
I don't
now.
Think like, you need an intervention bad? For cat love.
Okay.
Cats are fantastic. I have a lot of close friends that adore, like would do anything for their cats. I don't feel like they always have that look. Like I could scratch your eyes out if I want. Just at this moment, I'm not choosing to. So I'm not a cat guy. I feel like dogs are whatever.
No, but I think what's happening in my life now is that I feel like I'm taking care of so many entities. You know, it's like my three kids. I don't take care of my wife, but you know, you're giving. And then I've got my two dogs, Donut and Bronco. Donut is my English bulldog, who's just a total dummy, but sweet and great. And then Bronco is my German short hair pointer, who's smart and needs attention. And they all need attention. And the cat is kind of great because they don't. They can just do their thing and then come to you a little bit when they need a little this. And you don't have to worry about the cat. You know, yeah. I kind of like that part of it.
Yeah, I get it. I just think I'm with you in your original premise that you just don't need to add anything else to your life that need to takes away. So what does the cat then give you? You're not paying attention to the cat, and the cat every once in a while comes up and lays on your lap. Right. What do you get out of that?
Nothing. Nothing.
What about
you're
like
right.
a hunting cat?
Know. No, yeah, exactly. And then they just show you their like weird butthole.
Yeah, I don't. They just have an attitude. It's an attitude that I wouldn't accept in a person. I think that's it. Cats have an attitude that if it were a person, I wouldn't accept it. Like, maybe I'll come over there. Maybe I like you. Maybe I don't want that in an animal.
Well, I'm not getting a cat.
Good.
I don't need anything. I need nothing more in my life right now, but I am leaving for Colorado in 5 days, and I have never been more excited to get off of the grid, even though it's not fully off the grid, but I don't know. I have this feeling, which is just completely irrational and not even true, that the minute I leave LA and get into Colorado, like all my problems will be solved.
Yeah, I wouldn't do that because then when they're not, then you're going to be even more depressed. Can I suggest one thing? Can you bring like a new router with you? Something for your internet?
No, the second half, I think we were good. I got the whole house lined up.
Okay.
All right. You know,
because
for the longest time,
we had such a tough time with you would freeze up and then you'd tap out and it was because it was 1986 router before there were routers I might not even be saying the right thing. I don't even know if they're routers, but yeah, whatever your internet
dial
connection.
Up, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah. It almost ruined our friendship. That was tough.
Yeah. I didn't feel good about the start of our McConaughey podcast, which I haven't seen the numbers, but I think eventually will become the most listened to one we've done to date because you and I get on and we are just crushing each other I'm crushing you. You're screaming at me. And my wife and my daughter, Natalie, was like, I can't listen to that. I mean, I know exactly how he feels. Meaning.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah.
That's so funny. Well, I don't listen to the podcast, but you were like, dude, you got to listen to this. You know, when you texted me and I listened to it and it is, I mean, it's awesome. I loved hearing it back.
I was driving with my mom and I was taking her home and I put it on. I didn't really say anything. And my mom, who's 82, is like, now what is this? And it's us. It's you coming on just going berserk and me just kind of needling you along the way. And then the way we talk to each other, I was crying laughing. And my mom was laughing by the end of it.
Oh, good.
And, good. I think the main reason why I bring any of this up, or I wanted you to hear it back, is because you don't remember how it is after you do it. But then when you listen back to it after a little bit of time, that's the main thing, is that my daughter, who turns 25 mm-hmm. today, was like, I know exactly how he feels. I'm like, well, what about me? I mean, I'm waiting for like 10 minutes until he gets on. She's like, no, I know exactly how he feels. And Michelle the same way. So they took your side in our argument. That kind of pisses me off.
Oh my God, I love that. That's so funny.
Yeah.
They can relate. They were like, I can relate. That's so funny.
I'm not kidding. And I'm glad we put that stuff in, because that's how we are. And that's, I think, mm-hmm. kind of how we relate to one another and is the foundation mm-hmm. of our friendship. But because we fight and then we make up and mm-hmm. we're good, but it is intense when we're fighting. It's not good, especially on text, because then you add in another layer sometimes in yeah. text of tone that's not even intended.
But I think it's important, though, that you have those friends, you know? I mean, I think there's certain people, certain friends of mine who I couldn't have that relationship with. But you and I have a certain synergy to where you can give it to me, I can give it to you. It can get heated, whether it's via text or verbally. But there's a coming together, you know? Even if we are getting at each other, I know that there's still love, and I don't have to worry about it being the end of a friendship. Whereas with some, as you know, one of them, you know, yeah. that happened a little while ago.
Right.
You know, you like, it just ends. And I'm like,
have you spoken
Christ.
To that person since that blow up?
Nope. No.
That shocks me. That shocks me that you, both of you, but that other person yeah. would take it that seriously. Especially now, because that was around a certain event, and that event has come and gone, and everybody
yeah.
has taken a time out yeah. from that event, and you're, who cares?
I don't know. I don't know. I tried, you know what I mean? Like, I took, you know, I knew my part in it, and I took responsibility for it, and I made an apology, and I tried to look at the silver lining of things, and, you know, I didn't, it wasn't reciprocated, I guess, and that's fine. You know, fuck it. What are you going to do?
Yeah.
But my point is that it's nice that you can have those type of friends where you can vent, you can get it out, but you know that at the end of the day, we're Teflon. It's not going to damage us in any way.
I do that with Michelle too. And I feel like, you know, I don't want to be in a position where we're always fighting, but I also don't want to be in a position where I'm scared to fight, or I'm scared to talk, mm-hmm. or I'm scared to really give my opinion, or I'm scared to just be myself. Or I'm, and the same for her. I would never want that on her side. So I think there is value in fighting, as long as you do it in a fair way and you can kind of take a moment after, take a breath, and then laugh about it or just come back together. I've never understood couples and friends of mine who just don't fight. I feel like one of the two of you doesn't stand up for him or herself. I feel like, I don't mean fight, mm-hmm. like fight. I just mean want to be heard and like, no, I don't want to do it that way. And then you get into a little thing and then you move on. But I feel like both parties have to be heard.
Yeah. And then it's the reconciliation. I mean, right after we finished the show, I was texting you like, I'm sorry, dude. Like, I'm just a little nuts. I felt terrible.
I felt worse. I texted you and you're like, I'm reading your text and now I'm crying. And yeah.
I know I was. Oh, shit.
It's like, I'm not going to pick on the guy who I'm as big a fan as you have other than your family. So maybe there are equals, but I'm not going to mm-hmm. throw it all away because you were 4 minutes late to a podcast. That doesn't really add up. And then you know, if that's the case, then we probably didn't have a great friendship, which I would assign to that other example. You know, like if that back and forth ends it, you probably didn't have much to start with.
Right. Exactly.
It was real.
And that's, and by the way, that's not necessarily a poor assessment of what happened with this other person.
That's what I'm saying. You know, no, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah, you're right. You look back and you're like, well, maybe just the foundation, the depth wasn't there to sustain an argument, I guess, you know?
Right.
So
that's well said. You have to have the depth or the genuine love and care for somebody so that you can weather the fight and come out the other end in some ways better.
Let me ask you a question, actually. Now that, you know, when your girls are in their 20s, what does the fighting look like with your kids? And I ask you this because, you know, Wilder, end of school, Wilder's my 13-year-old, you know, he's slacking on these things. I want him to get credit in a class. And long story short, I got pissed off last night because he's been just slacking. And then he texts me this really vulnerable text about, why do you yell at me? And it makes me feel, it stresses me out, and it makes me feel, you know, this. And I was like, oh my God, it like devastated me because, of course, I'm now scared I've just ruined my child's life. But do you fight with the girls, and how does that look?
Yeah, but I
from
feel like
father
but they're
to
not
a kid.
So he's what? How old is he?
Well, he's 15? 13.
13.
He's 13. I'm just saying with
so
your
my
girls
that
know.
Are now over 20, when we fight or if I say something, they will put me in my place. I think they're probably the only two people walking the planet that can really put me in my place and make me stop what I'm saying or doing. But it took a while to get to that point. Like I felt like I was parenting both girls up until a certain age, and now that they're, you know, Trudy will be 22, Natalie just turned 25. So I that's over with. I want to be their friend. Mm-hmm. I don't want to be a friend in a fake way. I want to tell them how I feel. But, you know, for Trudy, who can get emotional or can get or shut off, I have to pick my spots. And I think you know where those spots are the older they get. And mm-hmm. they're gone. One's in LA, one's in New York. I live in St. Louis. So if that's the case, I can push only so far. And I'm not saying they're not going to come back to me, but I don't want to waste my time with them fighting over little things. One's got a boyfriend that they've been together forever. Really, both do. And I feel like they're managing their own lives that way. And I'm not mm-hmm. there for that. I'm not there to tell Trudy or Natalie when to come home. Or I'm not there to tell them, hey, get up and get out of bed. Or why are you still sleeping? It's noon, Natalie.
But what about just their sort of assessment of you nowadays as adult women, you know, who are saying, Dad, here's your fucking problem. I love you to death, but this is who you are. You need to fix this. I don't like that. I mean, does that ever not
I
that
think
blatant,
that's the next step.
You know?
I think that's the okay. next phase. I don't think we're in that phase right now, but as you told me on the podcast and privately, when you spent the time after we did Family Feud with Natalie, mm-hmm. and she's going on about how important my
approval.
Stamp of approval is, then, yeah. You know, I don't know that she did tell me that on a text just now because of what I just said to her for her birthday. But I think that's the next chapter. I think they're willing to talk to, like, they'll talk to my wife, Michelle, about that, their stepmom. They'll talk to you about that. They'll talk to their friends about that. But I don't know that mm-hmm. they come roaring back in with, Dad, let me tell you what's wrong with you. I don't, mm-hmm. we don't really have that. Maybe we should, but I don't know. We're not there.
No, maybe not. But I mean, honestly, with my situation, I was almost proud of him in a way. I just liked that he could be vulnerable with me and to be able to say that to me. And I said, hey, you know, I don't want to make you feel that way. And I'm going to think about it. And maybe I need to do it differently next time in the way that I speak to you, you know? And then of course I was like, but you can't just not study for a test and disrespect your teacher who has given you three chances to retake this fucking thing, and now you're blowing it off again. Maybe my tactic wasn't correct, but I'm still going to say something to you.
I think that the older they get, the more they ruminate on what you say, even if it might ruffle their feathers at the beginning, the way you do it. But it sinks in. Like, and I'm that
like
way still
parrot.
With my mom. Like a parrot. Like a great parrot just constantly in your ear going, you know,
right?
What's wrong with you? Hey, yeah, there's Dean Nice. Yeah,
All right, hold on. Can you guys hear me?
Yes.
Yeah,
pretty man. Loud and clear.
Oh, my gosh. I'm sorry I was late. I literally just came from the airport. I was shooting a Band-Aids commercial in New York yesterday. And came, like, and also I was DJing in New Orleans for like a Essence Festival pre-record. So when I came in here, I had to like reconnect everything.
Oh,
and I
God,
just
no.
No, it's all good, man. We were just talking about just kids and discipline and sort of, you know, when it's okay to or when you feel like, you know, you should, and then when you might have crossed a line with something that you've said. And in Joe's case, sort of having 25-year-old and daughters in their mid-20s, if they tell him what's up and basically say, here's what's fucked up about you and here's what you need to learn, and just sort of that evolution, I guess,
yes.
You know?
I mean, you're there too, Dean Ice, right? You've got a kid who's in her mid-20s, right?
Yes, I have. So here's what's funny. I have two daughters. One daughter is she's about to turn 25. She just graduated from Penn State Law School. So that's a different set of like, dad, I need you to pay for this thing. Then I have the 10-year-old daughter who was here with the dogs while I was away and just left because she doesn't want to deal with the dogs. So her mom and I are together. So she's like, the dogs are all yours now. I'm leaving. And I don't want two dogs. I just had one dog. So it's like, oh my gosh, man. Yeah, it's a lot. How many kids do you have, Joe?
I have two daughters that are 25 today and then 21, almost 22. And then I have two little boys who are twin 3-year-olds. So I've got it coming and going. I've got girls. I've got boys. Oliver has three kids that are right in the middle, two boys and a girl. So we've got really on this podcast alone, we've got every age group covered. And it's funny to go from, you know, the me with the water wings on my boys in a pool today compared to my 25-year-old that's out all night on her 25th birthday. I mean, it's you know, so eventually you as a dad, you have to evolve too. And your counsel and your advice has to change as they grow. And if, you know, she lives with her boyfriend. They're basically married. I'm not going to tell her when to come in. She's living her own life. So you just have to hope that you put enough in good stuff in so that they're making the right decisions when you're not around, which I would imagine is, I mean, you got to be so proud of your girl that went to Penn State Law School. Jeez.
Yes, yes, yes. I'm extremely proud of her. One, because what's funny was I remember when she was 5 years old, I wasn't doing that well financially. So when I lived out in Queens, she went to like the neighborhood kind of daycare, but it was really someone's aunt's house that was watching like all of these kids. And she was 5 years old at the time. And I went to pick her up one day and they were watching this show on Fox. I will never forget it. Judge Joe Brown.
Oh, I love Judge Joe Brown.
Judge Joe Brown. And I was completely livid. I was upset. Like, why are the kids watching Judge Joe Brown? They're like 5 years old and they were like glued to the television. And when we left, she kept saying, I want to be a lawyer. I want to be a lawyer. Since she was 5 years old, and the fact that she graduated from law school.
Oh my God.
Like, it's just a beautiful story, beautiful journey, and she never swayed from it. So I'm extremely proud of her.
Oh my God.
Now having, you know, similar to Joe, where you have a girl that you have sort of, you know, you've parented, and then now you have another one who you are parenting, not that you ever stop being a parent. But do you draw from experiences, mistakes, failures, and successes from your first time around and bring that into what you're doing now with your girl, with your little one?
Absolutely. So So, you know, unfortunately, man, you know, like I was married when I was really young, you know. But the beauty of that right now is that my ex-wife and I and her husband are like the best of friends, you know. They'll go on vacation with me when I play like these big events somewhere, and they'll give me multiple rooms. They'll come out. So I've had this benefit of like having like this kind of like community, you know, parenting. Like their daughter is like my daughter, you know, and we just, you know, I just had like such a wonderful time and a wonderful experience raising my oldest daughter because it's been such a community thing with the three of us. So a lot of the things that I've learned from you know, being a dad at an extremely young age kind of helps me now with, like, in terms of, like, being patient, learning to set aside the time, you know. But we continue to grow, though, because as an artist, you know, my life has always been changing. And it didn't stop until 2020. When we were, like, when we had to, you know, quarantine and we were on lockdown, I learned a whole set of parenting skills. Like, that was just because as an artist and as a DJ who was constantly traveling, I wasn't the one that was there with my kid. You know, I was always on the road. I did like almost 400,000 flight miles in 2019. You know, I was on a plane almost every day. So I had to learn about, while being home, that there's a different level of patience that parents that are there with their kids every day have to, you must have, you know. So some of those skills I'm still learning.
If you like conversations with multi-talented dads like today's episode with Dean Nice, go check out one of our past episodes where we talk with Michael Strahan about everything from playing in the NFL to his television career to nepotism, fatherhood, family, and so much more.
It is hard whenever you have a certain life or lifestyle, and then I don't want my kids to not in some way, shape, or form kind of benefit from it. But at the same time, I do have to remind the younger ones, the younger twins, okay, I just want you two to realize that this life is not your life. This is my life. The lifestyle is not your lifestyle per se. It's a byproduct of my lifestyle. So you're going to have to earn and work hard in order to keep it up in this way, shape, or form. Or, you know what? It doesn't continue.
Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back after the short break with more from today's guest, Dee Nice. This quarantine, everyone's looking for the silver linings. We always have been. I think that's human nature. And, you know, obviously your silver lining has been, it's been an amazing to watch it all go down. I mean, I remember when it was first happening, when you started DJing on Instagram, because, you know, I've been a fan of yours for a long time. You know, I've been into hip hop since I was a kid. You know, you, Scott LaRock, yes, you know, sir. KRS, that whole scene was definitely something that, I don't know why, being this rich sort of white kid from the Pacific Palisades, for whatever reason, you know, it just got inside of me. And so it's a treat for me to be talking to you right now and to watch it all go down over quarantine and to be able to put you on, have you in my ears, have my family listening while I'm making dinner or whatever. It was just such a treat and transformative and gets you through it all. And it was just a global dance party. And it was, so I just want to thank you for that, man. That was really special.
I appreciate it. That was another one of those things that started, you know, I talk about it, but I don't go too deep into why it started. A lot of it had everything to do with my kids, you know, like with the choices that were made as a parent. So like my daughter, you know, my youngest daughter and her mom lived in Michigan. I could have gone to Michigan to be with my child during the quarantine, but I saw what was happening. And I knew in order to continue the journey of what was happening, because it was really important. Like I was reading the comments the first few days and how this music was changing people and people were extremely sad. So I had the choice of, do I leave and go be with my kid, or do I continue to do something that's totally inspiring people that we thought was only going to last for a couple of weeks? Well, my kid can deal with it for a couple of weeks. I didn't know that I was going to see my daughter for like 4 months, because once I was in it, I just kept going. I kept doing it and kept trying to keep people inspired. But I also knew that it was going to provide a lot of opportunities. It wasn't about, you know, anything financial. It was just about, like, my dogs. Charlie. I just knew it was something that was inspirational for my kids, you know, and it was something that was really good for people. You know, it was sad that it went on for so long, but we were lucky. I mean, can you imagine had this happened, you know, pre-Instagram or pre-Zoom, you know, people would have been depressed. you know, when we couldn't have interacted this way, or we couldn't have danced together for so long, you know. So I'm just grateful that we have the technology to be able to do what we did.
Everybody needs that sense of community. Everybody needs that touch almost with another person. And I remember when it was happening, people were speculating that, oh, when this is all over, nobody's going to shake hands anymore. You know, like that's going to be the new way. And I don't know about you, but I feel like it's almost you want to do it more because we didn't get a chance to do it. Like you want to reach out if you're vaccinated and if you're in a position where, let's say both parties are, you know, you just want to give them a little hug, like, hey, it's good to see you. And I, your comment, which I thought was amazing and really hit home with me, is when you were DJing and doing it through social media, you didn't have a sense of how it was going over with the crowd, obviously, because of the situation. So you're kind of on your own. And instead of being able to read the room and that community and see the smiles and see people reacting to whatever you were putting on, it was really all on you. And I feel like in some ways it probably made the job a little bit more difficult because you're really just launching into something that you hope people are connecting with. And obviously we all know several awards later, they did. I don't know, just talk about that, what that's like when you're in a room compared to when you're on your own.
What's interesting about that is I found myself last year. You know, I've been in music. I mean, Oliver knows I've been in the music industry over 35 years at this point. You know, I spent the last 20 years as a DJ playing, big events from the Super Bowl to the Oscars and inauguration for the Obamas to all the clubs. Like, I've done a lot of things, but those events were events for someone else. I was playing your event. So a lot of times people will kind of like, you know, kind of not really, I wouldn't necessarily say dictate, but they would say, hey, this is the kind of vibe that I want. I'm either doing this old school 80s party or I'm doing a hip hop party with Stretch Armstrong and Clark Kent. With what I was doing online, that was the first time in my entire career that I felt that it was whatever it was that I wanted to do. You know, I grew up in a very specific time, you know, in the 80s. You know, I was born in the 70s, but I grew up as a lover of the 80s. You know, so if you had to sit back and if you were a hip hop lover and you were waiting for them to play Run DMC, or, you know, if you're an African-American kid waiting for them to play Michael Jackson on MTV, because remember, that's what we had. We only had MTV. Well, I had to sit through Bette Midler. I had to sit through Call & Oates.
Phil Collins.
All of those songs. Yeah. You know, Level 42. To wait for Run DMC.
Right.
And while sitting and watching these videos, I became fascinated with them. You know, like, come on, who doesn't remember the Meatloaf videos in like the 80s? And what the
hell, like, I would do anything for love. That
and
video.
I won't do that.
Yeah.
But like, so like as a DJ, and especially when I played those big nights on Instagram, I saw what the community was, and I saw what the opportunity was. It was to be able to just play music, because we've all been so separated. Like, a lot of us won't go to the old school dance clubs because you don't want to hear that, or the hip hop clubs. But here's a chance to just play everything and bring people together. So I think I'm going to have a harder time going back to in real life, because I don't know how people are going to listen to it all together. You know what I mean? Like, I really enjoy playing social media. Like,
well,
I
that's not, but you said it right. I mean, when you're a DJ for a living, you're right. I mean, it's, you go and you get paid and they say, oh, here's what we want. We want, you know, early 90s this, or we want rock and roll, whatever. But that's what was so great about it, is that it felt like it was coming from you. Sure. You know, you weren't obligated to do anything other than what was coming from your soul in that moment. And then you actually sparked an entire wave of it, because then, you know, Quest got into it, and then you got a lot of other people. I think Ninth Wonder I was listening to a bunch, you know, and then all these battles were happening, and you felt this sort of this groundswell, you know, and it was really, really, really cool. And I have to ask a question, though. Do you feel an obligation now? I mean, did you at any time you're like, oh shit, man, I got to get back on the turntables because now everyone is expecting this, and I just want to take a break?
Yeah, you know, I started taking breaks recently, you know, just, I mean, I'm enjoying this conversation and I love transparency. So, you know, about 2 months ago, I had my own little breakdown, you know, where I woke up one morning and I cried for 3 hours straight, just tears for 3 hours. I couldn't even stop it. And what I realized was that for the entire year that we were all dealing with this pandemic, I never faced what my insecurities were, you know, like I masked it with music. Every time I felt some kind of way, I would jump on Instagram and I would play music for people. And that kept me going and that kept me from feeling and dealing with the emotions. So, yeah, you know, like, do I feel an obligation? Not as much as I did early on. Early on, I definitely felt like I was reading messages from people that were, you know, where they, I mean, I'll see. I mean, obviously, you know, if you see 20,000 people in on an IG screen, it represents more like 125,000 because the technology doesn't have the ability to separate when you get off to answer your call. They kick you out, you know. Mm-hmm. So, like, you're looking at 100,000 people in there and people saying things like, you know, he blew up now and, you know, he's going to leave us soon. And that just weighed on me because we were still dealing with the pandemic and we were still quarantined. And I didn't want people to feel that way because I knew that the music was inspiring. But here's the beauty of it, you know, and not to make this about self-promotion, but it's really about how I know that this really resonated with people in such a beautiful way. You know, I have my first show coming up that was announced last week, right?
That's right, at the Hollywood Bowl, right?
The Hollywood Bowl. The very first day that it went up, we sold 12,000 tickets. And then today, you know, we found out that it was sold out. This is for a DJ.
That's Congratulations. Wow. That's awesome.
You know, and like, you know, that was the thing that kept me going throughout the entire pandemic was imagining, like, one day when we can all get together, that first show is going to be at the Hollywood Bowl. And, like, for it to happen is incredibly special, man. And you know, I don't know if you guys are you guys from Cali?
I live in L.A. I'm here now, yeah.
Oh, so you know how special that is, man.
And
so for people to want to fly from all over the world to be there and dance together and see each other for the first time is so special, man. So I'm truly humbled by what happened this year. You know, like I said, I found myself musically. I feel like I found myself as a parent where I know what's important in the lives of my children. Like, my kids are inspired right now. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, I watched it, as you guys have as well. Like, we watched our kids Zoom school while the dogs are barking. That was the first thing that my daughter said to me. I was trying to do a test today, and Charlie wouldn't stop barking. You know, if they can make it through this, if these kids can make it through something like this, man, then we still have to be strong for them. So I've learned a lot this year.
Well, thank you for sharing that, man, because, you know, Joe knows because I talk about it. I'm very transparent with the way that I feel and the things that I go through as well.
Well, so am I. You know, I mean, don't make it seem like I'm not.
Well, you're
I'm kind a fragile
Midwestern
little flower, too.
You're buttoned up a little bit, you know. Joe, when was the last time you cried, man?
When was the last time America's Got Talent's been on TV? I cry every show. Every show.
Wait, did you really?
I do. My wife, look,
I can't even imagine you crying, though, Joe.
I followed my dad into this business, and he was my best friend. When he died after 7 months in the hospital, I never cried. I never cried about it. I was there every day in the intensive care unit, and then whatever room he was in, I never got emotional about it. But God bless, I watched the Friends reunion, and they bring in a choir with Lady Gaga to sing Smelly Cat, and I'm crying my eyes out. Now, if you can, I need help is what I'm saying. I didn't cry about my dad dying, but I cry about a chorus and Lady Gaga singing Smelly Cat. So there's something in there that, I'm an easy cry, but it comes at weird times. So sorry, Oliver, I just wanted to tell D Nice that I'm not some, like, hardened freak.
You have feelings, right?
I have feelings, too, absolutely.
You do. Oh, yes, feelings of anger. I get it.
Yeah, oh, shut up.
No, but it's look, we're all going through it. I'm going through my shit right now as well, you know, but it's nice to hear,
you know, you say that. I mean, it's just, it's part of it. And you're right. I think we need to give our kids a little bit of slack. And I sometimes get on them too much. You know, I'm expecting a little bit too much of them, I feel like. And, you know, I'm dealing with that right now with my son, my 13-year-old, who I'm just like on his ass. But I might have to just settle in a little bit and understand that, you know, he's been going through a whole crazy year, you know?
Yes, yes. I love that. I'm falling in love with this podcast because as soon as I sign on, we're talking about being parents, and that's some cool shit, man.
But here's what we don't know. So we have a packet. We have a packet, and your girls are in there. Your relationships are in there. I see how you've reinvented yourself over the years, and now you said you found yourself. But I don't know how you grew up. How did you grow up? What kind of love were you getting at home? What was your family situation as a kid?
So I think, like, the way I grew up is part of what makes this journey so special. So I grew up, my mom, you know, my mom had me at 18. My parents did. They were both 18 years old, 17, 18 years old. So, and I wasn't raised by my mother. I was raised by my great-grandmother, not even my grandmother, my great-grandmother. And my great-grandmother and my cousin. My cousin is roughly 7 years older than me. And she had the onus of taking care of my great-grandmother and myself and her son. So she was a kid, raising a kid, but also raising her grandmother. And we lived in the Bronx in a 400-square-foot tenement apartment, you know. And my grandmother, my great-grandmother and I slept on opposite sofas in the living room. So those were the times when we made South Bronx our very first single with BDP. Mm-hmm. Like that's what my living situation was, you know, like growing up in the inner city. You know, I was always a smart kid, always into education. But then, you know, I didn't have the freshest clothes, you know, like, so then that you had that kind of pressure growing up in the inner city. And luckily for me, my cousin's boyfriend worked at a men's shelter in the Bronx. I was like 15 years old at the time, and he worked at this men's shelter called the Franklin Men's Shelter in the Bronx. And I used to cook dinner all the time at like 15, and he asked me to bring him some food to the shelter. Obviously, we didn't have Ubers back then. We didn't have enough money for taxis. So this was like a 3.5-mile walk to take him food. And I was sharing this story with our buddy Dave Chappelle. I was telling him this, and he's, you know, because he asked me, how did I meet KRS? So this was that journey. When I walked into the shelter with the food, my cousin said, hey, I want to introduce you to someone. Walked me into a social worker's office, and it was DJ Scott LaRock. And then Scott LaRock introduced me to a homeless guy that lived in the shelter, who was a rapper by the name of KRS-One. So, God. So when I told Dave this story, he said, man, do you hear what you said? You walk 3 miles with food to feed your future. Mm. And that's literally what that was. You know, had I not gone there, this would have been a different path, you know, like, but because I went and I took food to my cousin, it totally changed my life, you know. And from that point, I was always inspired by KRS-One and Scott LaRock, you know. And, you know, we put out our first record when I was 16 years old. And, you know, I've had ups and downs, but like never looked back, never swayed from music, always wanted to be involved in the music business, loved it. I still wanted to be an attorney, but I never told my daughter that. So the fact that my daughter is an attorney, or, you know, she just graduated law school, and the fact that I was able to pay for that for her, it just makes this journey so beautiful.
Man, how old do you think you were? And maybe it's an unfair question. When it dawned on you, the sacrifice that your great grandmother and your cousin made for you, you know, like, because somewhere along the line, you could have gone this way or that way. And you were always interested in education. You were always, you know, you said yes to walk the food 3.5 miles. You put yourself in a position to be successful and to, you know, whatever groundwork was put in. When do you think, you know, at what age or as you look back now as an adult with two daughters of your own, do you look back and go, man, these two women were so, so beautiful and so wonderful and so giving to me. Even if it wasn't perfect, they were willing to raise this little boy.
So I think about that all the time, actually. One of the things I think about is the fact, I mean, we grew up in a different time. I don't know how old you are, Joe, but you do have a 25.
I'm exactly your age. I'm 1 year old.
I'm assuming you are my age, right? So we grew up in a time where we did have a little bit more freedom than we actually give our kids now. You know, growing up, you know, I was a young kid that was able to, no one told me no, you know, like, because my cousin, she was only 21. You know what I mean? Like she didn't know how to parent. You know, she was trying to parent her child. For me, at, you know, 7, 8 years old or 9, 10, whatever it was back then, no one told me no. So I used to hang out on the streets and, you know, I just feel like people always looked out for me, right? So they always saw something good in me. So I don't want to just say it was just about these two women, because it was also about the people in the neighborhood. So I grew up in a neighborhood that was, you know, crime rate was high. Drug use was high. People were selling drugs everywhere. When I tried to do that, to sell drugs, those guys saw something different in me, the guys that would hang out on the corners, and they wouldn't allow me to do it. Like, and they would just say, they would say, "Shorty, no, this isn't for you."
Isn't that mind blowing to you, though, that somebody who's an adult doing something sees somebody else who may start to make the same mistakes or whatever you want to call it that they made, and they took the time to go, "You don't want to be where I am."
You don't. It's so beautiful, which is why I try to always give back. I try to go back to the neighborhoods to inspire that next generation, because where I am right now in my life is a reflection of like the people that looked out for me, the people that saw something good in me. So when you talk about what happened last year with the music and trying to inspire people, it's really because of what happened in my life, you know, with people doing just that for me, people making their own sacrifices to say, "Hey, this isn't for you. No, this is what I want you to do. This is the path you should be on." And that's why I always felt like it was important to do something that was inspirational.
If you're enjoying this episode of Daddy Issues, don't keep it to yourself. Share the love. Tell a friend about Daddy Issues and go subscribe on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Oh, and demand that they pay us.
Hey, stay tuned, everybody. You don't want to miss the rest of our conversation with D. Nice coming up right after this short break. Was your dad around at all?
No. I met my father when I was like 7. He was gone. And then I met him again when South Bronx was out, and he was gone then. Yeah, I have no relationship with him.
Did you have a father figure or a male figure in your life at all that, you know, was inspiring to you?
I was raised by all women. All women that kept me inspired. That's the truth.
Wow.
Yes, yes. It was always.
And as you look back, were you a tough love dad? Were you somebody that was, you know, that was coddling your children? Was it, you know, how would you look back on yourself as a father?
So my parenting style has always been, you know, I've never been, obviously I have daughters, so I've never been one to discipline with anything physical. Like, I don't believe in that. That's just not me, you know, like. I know that's the way a lot of older people grew up, but that's not something I try to be the type of parent that would just converse and talk about things with my kid and allow them to be heard, because I remember being young and wanting to be heard. I also remember no one ever told me I couldn't climb the tree. So so my parenting style is a little bit different. You know, it's a little unorthodox compared to mom, you know, where she went to country day school and she was, you know, she had this whole strict, you know, routine that she had to follow. I'm a free flowing artist. Like, no, you know, if that's what you want to do, all right, let's talk about it. Okay, well, why do you want to do it? So I'm that type of parent, you know, and I think it works well for us because there is a balance that you need. You know, I don't believe in good cop, bad cop, you know, anything that I say, we should be able to discuss this in front of each other, whether she's home, you know, our child is home with me or with her. You know, so I don't think I'm not saying I'm father of the year, but it's the best way that I know how to be dad. So, and it's just based on the way I grew up.
Yeah. So my dad, you know, my dad left when I was, well, the divorce was 5, but when I was 11, 12 years old, he was pretty much out of the picture. And it was rough. Kurt, my stepdad, came into my life and raised me, but still that biology was not there. But I remember making a decision in my late teens, early 20s. I knew I wanted to be a dad, but I also knew that I didn't want to be the dad that my dad was to me, meaning absent. And I was going to do everything that I could to break that pattern because my grandfather actually left my dad when my dad was young as well. You know, was there any part of you when you became a father that was like, I'm going to be there. Like there is no question in my mind that I'm going to break this pattern.
Every part of me, everything that I've done was for the legacy that I wanted to leave behind. At the time, it was just one child and it was just my oldest daughter. It was about not wanting to be that person. But when my youngest daughter was born, that shifted for me, you know, where it was, I felt like I spent too much time worrying about the type of father that I didn't want to be. And then when my youngest daughter was born, it was about being a great parent. Not, you know, because I also I didn't know what the circumstances that my parents had, that they had to deal with, you know, so I felt like I started to be too judgmental on my parents. Because it was really like one day I remember looking at my then 18-year-old daughter and I looked at her and I was, and at the time she was on, you know, she was like in college, Spelman University, you know, going to her second year. But when I looked at her, I saw my mother. And when I looked at my kid who was well-educated, she went to private schools all of her life. She was accepted into 11 schools, went to the school of her choice. You know, I looked at her and I was like, there's no way that this kid could raise a child. And it made me think about my parents. Like, they weren't, you know, they didn't have the same type of education. They grew up in a different time. Mm-hmm. And in that moment, I felt like I was being far too judgmental, that they did the best that they could with the skill sets that they had. Mm-hmm. And I needed to let go of that. Whatever that shit was for me, I just needed to let go of it, because the beauty of that relationship to me is that they also stayed out of my way. So I had the freedom to be the type of person that I wanted to become. And I didn't take on the traits that they had. Like, I became someone totally different. And this was a chance for me to inspire my own kids one day. And, you know, and I know that I did. You know, I know that I have a fantastic relationship with my daughters. And it's far greater than the relationship that I had with my own parents. And I have a great relationship with my mother now. Also because I learned to just let go and not be judgmental.
Yeah, dude, that's I get the chills because that, you know, you and I obviously have come from two extremely different places, but that mirrors my exact journey in the forgiveness for my father and actually finding deep compassion for him. Because he went through something that he didn't have the tool, he didn't have the tools, he didn't have the capacity to sort of learn from it. You know, he was damaged as well and was destined to repeat it in a sense, you know. And when you really get into it and you understand what those patterns are, shit changes and this sort of wave of forgiveness comes over you, and then this veil is sort of lifted. And now we're able to have somewhat of a relationship. It's not tight by any means, but it's starting, you know, at the age of 44. But no, it's interesting. And forgiveness essentially is selfish. You know, it's like, yeah, you're forgiving the other person, but you're also letting go of so much for yourself that allows you to move forward in a positive way, you know? So I feel that for sure.
Yeah, I think, and I don't know that you're going to say this, Dean, nice about yourself, but I think just to give an example, unless I'm wrong, your baby girl is in Michigan if she's not with you. Is that right? And you would get up at 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock in the morning and make sure that you were on FaceTime with her and kind of get her day started and let her know, hey, dad's here, even if I'm not right there. It was important for you. So that kind of answers the question that Oliver had earlier. That's how involved you want to be, that you set your alarm clock, you're making tea in the morning just to make sure that you have, it's not FaceTime the app, it's face comma time with your girl so that's how she starts her day. I just think that's really cool.
Yes, and that has always been important because I traveled so much. And, it's important to be there. Fortunately for me, my ex and my daughter, they now live in Los Angeles. So she bought a house here in Los Angeles. Mm. So my daughter spends half of her time with me now. And then she spends the other half with her mom. But we still wake up at 4 a.m. We wake up at 4 a.m. because she was still going. She's doing virtual school in Michigan until the end of this semester. So we wake up every day at 4 a.m. to make sure that she's doing. So that's what I was doing during the pandemic. So like after the first 4 months, when my daughter finally came with me to be here with me in Los Angeles. Yes. And school started every morning. I was up at 4 a.m. making sure that she was set up, at the table and we would do that. And then I would do my events and then I would still DJ. And then at night I would play and help her with homework.
Maybe
and get
when
back
you
on.
Cried for 3 hours, you were just tired. It's okay to be tired. You're burning the candle at every possible end.
I was tired, man. You know what I did, Joe? I cried for 3 hours and then I just decided, you know what? I'm going to get in my car and I'm going to drive to Utah. And I drove by myself to Utah and I stayed at a resort out there for 5 days, took no music with me. I just spent 5 days doing absolutely nothing but things that made me happy. I went rock climbing. I went horseback riding. I was just doing
stuff
things
that grew up doing in the Bronx.
Well, you didn't go horseback riding in the Bronx.
I know. I'm just kidding. I've been to the Bronx a few times. Yeah.
That's good though. That's self-care, It's like it's get up and get out.
Get up and get out, man. This is great. This is great.
It's so funny that you did that, but music is not a part of it. Whereas for the rest of the world, music is kind of the conduit. Music is the way that we all kind of start to unwind. It's like a trigger in our mind. To you, it doesn't mean it's a bad thing, but music is your work, So I would imagine, people always say to me, if you're sitting on the couch and you're watching a Super Bowl and you're not doing it, or you're watching a World Series game and you're not doing it, or just a regular old game, can you watch a game and not call the play-by-play in your head, which is what I do for a living? And the answer is probably no. Like, I'm constantly looking at it and in my mind. So therefore, if I'm not working, I'm not dying to go sit in front of a TV and watch a game. For you, is it the same way? Or if you're listening to music, are you listening to the bass line? Are you listening to what could come next? Is your mind always turning that way?
I listen to music. That's the beauty of music and creativity. I listen to music the same way I did when I was 15 years old. So that's why I can play 19 hours straight. It's because I really do love music. And I love sharing the music with people. That's the other thing that was so beautiful or is beautiful about my particular social media following is that it could be John 7:2-4 and then Bobby Flay will be in there. And we're all listening to the same music. And it's the most eclectic group of people. Where it's like, and Bobby Flay will say, oh my gosh, you're playing the Benjamins from P. Diddy. Like, this is my song. But then this black kid, John 7:2-4, is like, yo, level 42 is like, yo, I grew up. So it's like, it's almost like the music that people secretly listen to, didn't want anyone to know. But like now we're in this room together and like we all love it all. And it's like, I get such a kick out of that, that it just makes me happy. So the music isn't what caused my fatigue. It was really just doing it over and over again, doing it so much, because every time I can't listen, as soon as I'm off with you guys, I'm about to play a set. I haven't played a set online in like a week. I've been traveling. I can't wait to play a set. I'm like dying to just play some music right now.
Oh, just when you do, say, hey, I just got off the best podcast of my life. Here's the name of it. And when I drove to Utah, I didn't listen to music. I listened to back issues of Daddy Issues, and it blew my mind. It changed my life.
That's exactly what I'm going to say.
Okay, good. Great. Fantastic.
So I have to, before we get out, and I have a couple more questions, but I just for personal reasons, like, how, I know Chappelle already asked you this, but how did it happen with Scott LaRock and KRS, and how was BDP? How did that happen? I mean, I was at the shelter, and KRS was homeless, but then what was the synergy that brought you guys together to then start getting into the studio to make music?
Well, so Scott LaRock and KRS had been in the trenches together, and like, you know, KRS was his MC. Like he, you know, Scott would DJ at clubs at nighttime, but by day he was a social worker. And, you know, they would go out and KRS would battle all of these MCs, and then he would go back home to the shelter. When I met them, which is funny though, because Scott LaRock, immediately when he met me, he looked at me and said, "You're going to be in my group." I didn't know how to rap. I didn't know how to DJ. I didn't know how to produce. I did nothing in the music business, but he saw me, and what he said was, "You remind me of LL Cool J. You're going to be the LL Cool J of our group." So he kind of pulled me into the situation. KRS didn't really agree with that, you know, because they were doing so much together already. He's like, "Well, why are you pulling this kid into it?" So KRS and I had never really had like the tightest relationship, even though I was like producing on the early BDP albums after Scott passed away. We just never really had that same connection that I had with Scott, or the connection that he had with Scott, which is so crazy that. So yeah, I know we talked about Daddy Issues and all of that, but then there's also like the Big Brother issues. So for my entire career, I felt like I lived in the shadow of KRS-One, of one of the greatest MCs. I came from that era and from that music and from that group, and he truly an icon. And I lived in the shadow of KRS. And so when I say to you how important 2020 was to me, it took 3 decades for me to finally feel like I am no longer living in the shadow of someone else's greatness, that I'm just being me, you know, like, because that was something that I carried with me for decades of like, I kept doing things because I wanted to like not just be affiliated with that. Not that I wasn't proud to be from that group. I'm not here without that journey. But I also wanted to be respected for my accomplishments and my contributions to the culture.
But when My Name Is D-Nice came out and it had some success, as I don't know what, it sold 500,000 or something like that, right? I mean, but back in the day, obviously you want to get to the millions and all that, but it had success. I remember that. I remember that song. Were you in that moment of like, okay, shit is happening? And then that's it, right? I mean, was that a moment for you and then you had to pivot?
So that was a great moment for me, right? So one, I did the track Call Me D-Nice for Kid Rock because I got Kid Rock his deal with Jive Records back in the day. So I found Kid Rock, got him his deal. That was a beat that he didn't like. So I just laid my old vocals on top of it. And then it became a hit. The problem that we were having with the record company was music has shifted. So you know, in the late 80s, everything was about conscious lyrics, you know, black empowerment, like, you know, Public Enemy, KRS, Ice Cube. You know, we were all trying to find ourselves. That's the generation that I grew up in. But then I was still young. You know, KRS is like 8 years older than me. So I was still young and considered old school because I had started so young in the business. That by the time like 1992, when Diddy and Biggie and all these guys, the music industry started to change, you know, like sound of it changed. So it was the sound that I loved, but that wasn't the generation that I was from in terms of like making music. So the record company shelved me. So it wasn't that I didn't want to make more music. They just didn't believe me. So I was like on the shelf. That's why, you know, when I say that this journey has been so beautiful, I literally had to find myself throughout decades of like not allowing someone or or a record company or a genre of music define who I am. And even though I was angry, who wants to be shelved? You know, when you're creative, you know, I couldn't go out and get a new deal. It was actually the best thing that happened to me because I would not be here right now without everything that I experienced. So, yeah, man, it's a beautiful thing.
And then what's next? What's the, you got the Hollywood Bowl, but you know, 5 years, I don't even gotta go that far, but what are we feeling? What's inside of you that needs to come out beyond what you're even doing right now?
So, you know, right now I started making music again. I have a single that's like number 6 on the charts featuring Neo. I'm literally about to release this album on this. Oh my gosh, I almost said who's on it. I haven't really announced it yet, but we've just been slowly trying to get that out there. But no, I have like a lot of superstars on here, man. You know, like awesome. I'm not lying. So it's in the veins of DJ Khaled, in the veins of David Guetta, you know, but it's more on the R&B kind of soulful side, but with top artists, you know, like, and that's been an amazing journey. You know, I also have like, I have 2 book deals, you know, I'm a photographer, so I've been shooting.
Yeah, we didn't touch on that. Yeah.
You know, for a very long time, I finally have my coffee table book deal. So I want to show this stuff. I have like,
I mean, sorry to interrupt, but the archive photos that you have must be insane, right?
I have a lot of photos in the archive.
Yeah.
You know, and I just feel like I'm doing everything that I love, man, you know, and it's been that journey from the beginning. So I want to continue on that path, you know, and I also want to get more into filmmaking. I have, you know, a couple of deals on the table now. So just to tell these stories of really, and in particular, hip hop culture, and not just from one specific part of it, you know, hip hop changed the world, man, like changed the way we all listen to music. And it wasn't just because of Black culture. The music itself brought so many people together, and I want to tell stories like that, you know?
Mm. Awesome, buddy.
Man, it's so inspiring to hear your story. And, you know, I suggest, and I know you know this, I'm not telling you something you don't think about all the time, but next time you you have those insecurities or you have that session where for 3 hours you don't feel that great, just think about those 2 girls and what you've done and the mold you've broken there and how you've put one through Penn State Law School, which is wow. And then you've got another one that you're putting together and ready to unleash on the world too. I mean, you are doing a lot of great things, and it's an honor to have you on. I'm thinking maybe a duets album with you and me. Like, have you ever thought about doing like a 52-year-old balding play-by-play announcer kind of thing?
We're both balding, so I was going to suggest that. You know, I think, you know, it'll be...
I saw it in your eyes. Oh, man. Awesome. Well, we're obviously both fans, and we're so psyched
that you
wanted to come on. And, man, thanks. Thanks for your time today. Man,
I wasn't going to miss it. I was rushing from the airport. I was like, I got to get there.
We appreciate it.
I'm a fan, so this was therapeutic for me as well. And I appreciate you guys allowing me to just be, you know, just, you know, vulnerable and transparent. Yeah. You know, like, and that's... you know, it's hard to find a safe space like that where people respect it, man. So thank you both.
No, thank you, man. I appreciate you. This has been really, really cool. Thank
All right,
you.
Be well. Play a great set. Remember, remember, just start with, hey, daddy issues, wherever podcasts are available, Spotify, whatever that old tired phrase is.
And I can't, I'll come up with the name for our duets album.
Okay.
So, all right, perfect.
Good.
All right, fellas. See you guys.
All right, see you, man.
All right, take care.
All right. Later, buddy.
Oh, Oliver, that was great, man. What a thrill. What a great guy. God,
awesome. Jesus. That was really fun. Really cool, man. Inspiring. Just works. You just never know what path your life is going to take. You know, it can take such a hard left or a hard right or whatever. I mean, D-Nice has been around forever. You know, and he's been a photographer, he's been a DJ, he's traveled the world, but no one really knew, you know, who D-Nice was, you know, I mean, the world, of course, you know.
Sure.
And then this happens, and he's created this space for people to come together,
you know, when we all were so far apart and were unable to connect, and he created that platform for that connection, and now is doing all of the things that he wants to do. And it's pretty fucking inspiring. And it's just, you just never know when it's going to happen. You never know when that lightning is going to strike.
That old phrase of necessity is a mother of invention. And it's insulting during a pandemic where people, you know, lost lives and lost loved ones and you know, all the uncertainty and lost jobs and lost whatever, to say that somebody, quote unquote, won quarantine. But I've heard that phrase out there before, like so-and-so won quarantine. He's one of the people that took that opportunity and found his way through it and reinvented himself. But if you think about his whole, you know, he's been an actor, he's been a photographer, he's been a rapper, he's been a producer, he's been all these things. And now, you know, he won the Webby Award, he won a BET Award, he won all of these awards during 2020 because he found his footing at a time where people needed it, and it resonated with people. So even though it's, I guess, on one hand demeaning, I mean it. Like, he deserves credit, big time credit, for taking advantage of an opportunity, finding his way, and just relaunching what was already a really good career into a great career where he can sell out the Hollywood Bowl.
Sure, but he did. But I don't think you even need to amend the winning quarantine, because he didn't do it from an opportunistic place. He did it from a place of love and from his heart.
Yeah.
Meaning, I want to play music and I want to bring people together. It's that fucking simple. You know,
right.
He wasn't getting paid to do all this. This was just coming from his soul. So, yeah, he did win quarantine.
And you know what I mean when I asked him that question? It would be like a comic telling jokes on Instagram and just going through the whole set, but never seeing anyone smile or anyone laugh. So he's playing his music, and he is not seeing anybody smile. He's not seeing anybody dance. He's not seeing, because I would imagine anytime you're a DJ or you're in a band or whatever, you're reading the room and you're constantly, well, that was, you know, that didn't work. So if that didn't work, then this won't work and this won't work. I got to go this direction or whatever it is.
Yeah.
And he finally said, you know what? This is what I want to listen to. And it just so happened that 100,000+ people wanted to listen to it. And that's what, you know, kind of gave him his validation. So good for him. I think it's awesome.
It was awesome. Well, he's going to go do a set now. So you, looks like you're in a beautiful place. You should put it on one of your speakers. Just get your Instagram and you can do the live and it can play over your speaker. Maybe he will give Daddy Issues a shout out.
How great would that be? God, people are like, what? Look, What's wrong with you?
Right.
D-Nice is a sellout. That'll be the headline.
Totally.
Yeah. Oh God. Here's a self-serving moment for me and or us, but that I'm sure he's never heard this podcast before, but that he kind of got right into the flow of it's okay to be vulnerable and just kind of talk about insecurities like right out of the gate. I love that.
Oh, me too. And even just, you know, when D-Nice or when other people sort of say how much they're enjoying it in the middle of doing it, you know that it's true and they're feeling something in that moment. And it makes, again, it's self-serving, but it makes me feel good.
Yeah, like we're not wasting our time. But, you know, this much is true. That's what that might be in the set. I know that much is true.
Well, he could play the PM Dawn version of it because they sampled that. You know what I mean? So,
level 42.
God. Yeah, level 42.
Give me one level 42 song. Cause there is something about you. Is that them, baby? Tonight. Is that them?
I just love your voice.
I couldn't live without you, baby. Tonight. Is that level 42 or not?
I don't even know. I have no idea.
Yeah, you do. You're acting like you don't know.
I don't know.
We can wrap up with this. What's your guilty pleasure? What is the worst music that, at least I would think is the worst music, that you go to and it's your happy zone that I wouldn't think you would like?
Wow. I don't know if you don't think I would like, but I'm a big like Christopher Cross fan.
Who doesn't like that?
I mean, I know you like that, but like Sailing, if Sailing comes on, it literally takes me away to the place, you know. it actually takes me there.
Yeah.
I just feel something in my body. I just relax and soon I get you nostalgic. Will be free. Yeah. I just feel like it's my life for reasons that don't make any sense. I love it. Sailing just makes me feel happy.
Okay, good.
But that's not one that you would, you know.
Not like.
Yeah. But I think you would like every Guilty Pleasure song.
Yeah, the song. You know? But like Sean Colvin for me is one that you wouldn't think. Is it mixed in with everything else? Sean Colvin is a female guitar player.
Yeah, yeah.
Sonny came home. Sonny came home. She's great. I saw her in concert in a concert in the round, and she was down there playing her guitar, and she's just great. She's got a great voice. It's very soothing to me. All of her songs.
Yeah, okay. You're a Sean Colvin fan.
Yeah, I am.
Let's get her on the show.
Damn proud of it. She's got to have daddy issues somehow. Everybody's got daddy issues.
We should do that. We should do a Guilty Pleasure episode. We just get like one of our Guilty Pleasure, you know, moments and bring them on.
Yeah.
You know, like someone from Below Deck for me. You know.
I'm having, and I don't care what you say about it, my hair doc is coming on.
I'm down. Let's go.
I'm going to have to evaluate you. That's not well, why. Now, but I'm going to have to evaluate you.
You have gotten in my head a little bit. You have. Like, now I'm like looking at myself like, is Joe Ryan feels thinner? And now you've got me tripping. Like, I don't have enough shit to sort of figure out. But,
so I am the Bryson DeChambeau to your Brooks Koepka in your head about your hairline?
Oh, God, this is it's the greatest feud of all time.
It's the greatest and yet somewhat annoying, I have to say.
I know. Well, they're not, it's almost like they're not sharp enough. You know what I mean? If they were a little bit more witty and, you know, Brooks Koepka's funny. Like, he says some funny shit, you know? But it I don't know. It's missing something. There's an ingredient that's missing from it. I don't know what it is.
Right. Should be full contact golf. They're both huge guys.
That would be great. It'd be great. They should, you know, they should box.
They should box. They should do what we used to do in football, which I think has been outlawed, called the Oklahoma drill, where you lay on your back, helmet to helmet, across from the other guy. Coach blows a whistle. You get up and you got to like beat, you got to take.
Yeah.
You got to get through the other person. So they should do that. Oklahoma drill, get through the other person, then just run and tee off.
Yeah. Well, Bryson would take him. Bryson's too strong.
He's big. He's a big man, but so's Koepka.
Bryson will take him.
Okay. I'm not messing with Koepka anymore. So I've done that. Been there, done that.
Yeah.
I hope Josh cuts all of this out. All right. I will, I'll talk to you later.
Bye. Listen to Daddy Issues on the iHeartRadio app, on Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Daddy Issues is a production of Cavalry Audio and iHeartMedia, produced by Margot Carmichael.
Sound engineering and editing by Josh Windisch.
Executive produced by Joe Bach, Oliver Hudson, Dana Brunetti, and Keegan Rosenberger.